It's Sunday, October 16th, 2011, and this is the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 17. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? The RCR is the podcast about computer history, nostalgia, and collecting by computer history enthusiasts for computer history enthusiasts. I'm today's host, and I'm Earl Evans in Portland, Oregon, the only member of the RCR on the left coast. I'm host of the RetroBits podcast, and next we have Carrington Vanston, and he's in Toronto, Canada. Little known fact, Toronto in the native tongue means colder than Iceland. He's the host of 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast, and co-host of the Double Take podcast. Hey there, Carrington.
Hello, and that is actually a true fact about Canada.
So how are you doing today?
I'm chilly. It is actually colder than Iceland here today. Today is freezing cold, but I am doing very well. Good times in Carrington land.
Good. You know, Toronto is probably the only city I've been in where I literally thought I might freeze to death. We were there. I don't know why we decided to visit in the dead of winter, but we found out why they have that underground pathway. In Toronto.
Which is awesome. Actually, one of my favorite parts of the downtown, yeah.
I love the path. So, anyway, okay, now on to David Grealish. He's in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area. I don't know where the lesser Atlanta, Georgia area is, but he's in the greater one. David, another little known fact, is the founder and custodian of the only known sanctuary for chia pets. He reads the Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast and sometimes does a classic computing video podcast. Hey there, David.
I'm going to need more water over here. Yeah, this one and these. They haven't been watered yet. Oh, hey. Hey, Earl. What's up?
Hey there.
I'm just keeping the crops watered over here. Good. You know, it's just the opposite weather-wise. It was very warm today. Got up into, and yesterday too. So it actually broke into the low 80s today here. So, what's going on?
Yeah, we're having unseasonably warm and dry weather here in Portland, too. My wife is lamenting that we're not really having a crisp fall. It's kind of weird. The trees aren't even really changing over yet. So, weird stuff.
Now we hear from another region.
Yeah. Sort of. And today, also, we've got a special guest, Blake Patterson. He hails from Alexandria, Virginia, in the greater D.C. area. And when he's not hailing, he runs the vintage computing blog, Byte Seller, one of my favorite blogs. Have followed it since, I think, nearly the beginning. And Blake is also editor and co-founder of the iOS gaming news site, TouchArcade.com. He's got good tweets, too, at the Twitter handle, at BlakeSpot. Hey there, Blake.
Hey, how are you doing? It's an honor to join you guys on the podcast. This is definitely one that I've followed for, well, since the beginning as well. So
cool. Excellent.
Very cool. Very cool to be here. Definitely.
Awesome. Well, we're happy to have you here. So, you know, definitely we don't want to miss the chance to ask you about your websites. So maybe we ought to start with Byte Seller. Tell us.
I thought you were going to say about the weather.
Yeah, exceptional weather today. Exceptional weather. No complaints. No complaints.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, Byte Seller, I love that blog. It started quite a few years ago, right? Maybe tell us a little bit about what got you into retro computing and also what got you started on that blog.
Sure, I can go through that. Yeah, I set it up in 2004, and it actually, you'll hear in a moment or two, you'll hear about Touch Arcade, who I co-founded with Arnold Kim. He's the guy behind Mac Rumors. And anyway, I've been friends with Arnold for quite a while, and he had created a little social network site just for friends, you know, kind of a private thing. And so for years prior to 2004, we'd all been chatting, you know, about things that were fun to chat about, and I would throw in the retro computing projects I was working on, and it really, there was no one that cared. And so it felt a little lonely, so I thought, okay, there's got to be a better way to kind of share some of the, you know, revel in the news of the retro and what I'm working on. And so I started the blog, and it's been actually a great deal of fun. It's, you know, just some of the news stories to share it with folks that you know, might be reading the site or some of the little projects that I work on. It definitely that's I'd actually say that's the bigger part of what's fun about it. You know, because I think if I did it and didn't tell anyone about it, you know, it wouldn't be that rewarding. But yes, and so I guess it's how as far as how I got into retro computing, I was pretty much a one. I mean, I've went through a great number of computers. From I got my first computer in 82, Christmas. It was a TI-99-4A. Any of you guys have a TI at any point?
Okay. I did, yes. Mm-hmm.
I have one.
It was kind of an oddball machine, but yeah, I still have
a terrible keyboard.
Yeah, it's a strange one, and the you know lots to be said about that. But so you know I went. It was like one machine after the other, and I moved frequently. And then I think it was like in the early 90s, I decided I bought my first second computer. I was like, okay, I've got the main computer. Well, I'm going to buy like a – actually, I bought a TI again, and then I bought an Amiga. And then so I started kind of adding the second ones. And it was a lot of fun to set them up. And so I think now I've got like – in the room I'm sitting in, I've got 13 or 14 set up. I'm not very interested in kind of putting them on the shelf. They're all set up and operational. Some, you know – A good number of them that you might not think are internet enabled are in fact internet enabled, and that's kind of a cool thing. And yeah, so it's just I had so much fun as a kid messing with that stuff, and you know, reading Creative Computing magazines even as I was starting out, like looking at like every page was a different system with a different operating system, and it was you know it was just so much more exciting than Windows, Mac OS X, and Linux, you know. So. That's kind of been my hobby for quite a while, and it's enormous fun. So there it is, and that's Byte Cellar, I guess. That's kind of what that's about. And I'm glad to hear that Earl, that you've enjoyed it. And I'll before the show started, I was mentioning that Earl got me into following the Retro Computing podcast. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago with RetroBits, and so I don't want to make him a diva.
Definitely no cranial inflation.
I think it was you, and then 1 megahertz, which was I guess a little more sporadically scheduled. You know,
like once every 5-6 months.
Yeah,
well, I have the latest one. It's just being uploaded actually as I record this, which might be a little dangerous.
Well, I look forward to that. Yeah, it was. Awesome. I was looking at the timeline, and it was not like if it was a heartbeat, it would be an ill patient. but yeah, so but it's a great, and you've got some hardcore stuff on your site, and then actually the main reason I'm here on the that I took you know the opportunity to join you guys after the invitation was just to see when my cash is going to turn into a book from David. I've paid all this money and I haven't seen it. I'm starting to think it was like a bait and switch. So, I don't know. I hope you guys didn't pay into it because
I foolishly did.
I'm getting a little worried.
I should have known because David is like the shiftiest guy I know. So I should have known.
Probably get a box of rocks in the mail. In like,
yeah, I mean the twitchy eyes. You just yeah.
I can't wait to, you know, the first step is to post pictures of look here they really are, and then of course start sending them out.
Photoshop.
So I've had some issues with the printer, not the printer's fault though, but very very soon. So I'll leave it at that.
Whatever you say.
I promise.
Yeah, that's coming out like way. 1 megahertz
in the mail.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you know, Blake, yeah, I found your. I started reading your blog. I think shortly after I discovered Earl's podcast. So I'm going to say.
Oh yeah.
Cause I think 2006 sometime. Yeah. So, because I was looking for things to read, and of course other podcasts, and you know, and then I jumped on Carrington's when his came out, and then there was Boring Beige Box
Forever as well. Yeah.
And then A2 Forever. Wow, isn't that what it was,
yeah.
Carrington? The
Ryan Suodaga?
Yeah.
Suodaga, yeah.
What was his podcast called? Yeah, no.
Oh, yeah, no, that was A2 Unplugged.
A2 Unplugged by Ryan Suodaga.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing, I was, you know, listening to RetroBits, and I liked it all right. It was fine and everything. And I wasn't, you know, I was kind of, we'll see how this goes. And then I heard, you know, like early on, I hear Earl mentioning Byte Cellar. And that's when I realized that, you know, RetroBits actually had its stuff together. So, yeah. It was worth listening to. That's when I got serious about it. So, in all truth, that was actually a thrust. I was saying the first when I discovered it, I was on a week vacation at Nag's Head with my family, and like every morning, I would walk my daughter in the stroller back and forth to the coffee shop. We'd have donuts, and I'd listen to basically to a full podcast every morning. So I listened like to that week. I listened to like six, and like on the second day. You mentioned Bite Cellar. I was like, well, I always fell off, I always fell down. And so that was really cool. And so,
we're lucky in that there is such a surfeit of options for people interested in retro computing and getting stuff from podcasts. Like there's so many different ones out there and so many different approaches that I think, it's really easy for people to find at least a couple that they like. Like I was a big fan of Ryan's, obviously, H2 Unplugged, but also like Open Apple and stuff like that. Like as you guys know, I skew so much towards the Apple side of things when it comes to retro things. And I'm really lucky that there's so much out there and so much also for the general variety of retro computing stuff. So it's a good time for retro computing podcasts.
Yeah, it's definitely the amount of stuff out there. Sadly, when Brian Suinaga, unfortunately died, that was the first time I was unfamiliar with the podcast. I mean, somehow I had missed it. And then I think I was getting Ken Gagne, from Open Apple, his reaction. Mm-hmm. He had such a strong reaction. Obviously, they were close friends. Mm-hmm. And, that's when I really feel as if I missed out on this guy who was active in so many different capacities. And, so that's very unfortunate. And
he really was.
I kind of want to go back and, listen through, even though it'll always be tinged with kind of a cloud, unfortunately. And I will say unrelated to Ryan is yes, just Carrington, in case you weren't aware, I also am Apple skewed, so I'm on your side.
I'm Apple, sure,
Apple and Amiga skewed. It's kind of those two things, so but mainly Apple.
Yeah, well, I'm a fan of your blog, so I knew that too. And yeah. Do you listen to the Open Apple podcast? Because I love that one.
Yeah, I've listened since it was great. They popped up one day and it was great to hear. Mm-hmm. And I've enjoyed that. And
I like that it's a two-header, that it brings a different sort of feel than those of us just sort of rapping into a mic. I like that it's more of a discussion between Ken and Mike, so I really enjoy that.
Yeah, and I have to start. I think I've twice made the mistake of, they do the can you identify the game music? And like I'll immediately publicly tweet the answer, and then Ken is like, if you wouldn't mind keeping that quiet, because we like to provide a fair.
Well, a couple of shows ago, I don't know if you heard, but Mike gave away the answer on microphone, so that one was kind of easy.
That was funny.
But if you recognize it, I mean, you stand up, you're like, oh, I know that one. I know it. It's so and so.
Yep.
Yeah, but so. Yeah, okay.
Well, so you've got the retro thing going, but you've also got the new, iOS. I mean, these touch devices are the new kid on the block, right? So tell us a little bit about TouchArcade.com.
Okay, yeah, not to take up the whole show, but TouchArcade.com, I've been, I guess close friends with Arnold Kim of MacRumors since we were in like middle school. We grew up, together, same town, same, neighborhood basically. And so he started MacRumors and, we've kind of been connected as I went through. I ran iPodHacks.com in the past, and I ran on a Philips Nino site actually in the past when the first Windows CE machines came out, all kind of stuff. But anyway, as soon as Apple, the iPhone came out, I was actually with Arnold at the 2007 Macworld San Francisco Expo, which might have been Jobs, and I know we'll talk about that shortly, but at his strongest. I mean, when they announced iOS, it just blew everyone's mind. My mouth was actually on the floor, my jaw. So that was great. And then, everyone is doing web, web apps. You're going to do apps through the web. And that was not quite as good. And then they announced the App Store. And so as soon as they announced the App Store, it became immediately obvious that games were going to come. And games were going to be big because looking at the hardware, it was pretty powerful hardware compared to what was out there on the mobile front. And, so that's when I guess it was about 3 or 4 months before the App Store launched in March of 2008 that we started the site. So it's been 3.5 years. It was for a little over a year. It was Arnold and myself alone, and we've branched out. Now we've got aside from Arlen and myself, we have 3 full-time writers and 3 freelance writers. So we're pretty well staffed up. We're, you know, we're very happy. We're surprised. It's done a lot better than we had imagined it ever would in that amount of time. You know, I think we probably are the, you know, the biggest, kind of the most momentum of the iOS game review sites. I mean, that's a kind of a small area, I guess, but still it's, you know, it's kind of a hot area.
Yeah. And pretty important stuff.
Well, I mean, we're happy to see Apple embrace the iPod Touch as a gaming device early on, and they've really advanced the hardware. You know, if you look at the iPad 2 and the 4S, which just came out, and I did get in line at 4:45 a.m., and I have my 4S. And I have an excellent video that I'll have to share with you guys later with a little Chariots of Fire music, which is a little dramatic, but we won't get into that right now. But anyway, I mean, the 4S, if you look at it, it's got not that much less CPU and 50% the GPU power of Sony's NGP, you know, or the whatever they call the, you know, the hot new mobile
PSP.
Well, the new one, you know, I can't remember the name. I can't remember the name of it, but it actually is able to push more 3D graphics than the PS3. So basically, you're talking about an iPhone that has half the graphics power of a PS3, and that's or more. That's not bad. So anyway, games are a big deal, and that's what we've been doing. I went in January. Finally, after 10 years in my office job, I went full time. So I am 100% Touch Arcade, and I've been working from home ever since, and that's been great. And actually, it's the longest span of time I've ever gone. Well, in 10 years, I've gone without a cold, not being on the metro and the bus, not being on the subway and the bus, which is interesting. Mm. Yeah, it's crazy to be not been sick in this amount of time. It's crazy, the public transportation, gosh.
I remember when you announced that about quitting your regular job, and if it's okay for me to ask, so what did you do? Before, what was your regular work?
It's fine. I worked for 10 years for the AFL-CIO.
I remember that.
Labor movement. I was a web developer. We did. Our platform was mainly Oracle, ColdFusion, little PHP, MySQL, but that kind of thing. And it was fine. But I started having reasons to depart about 2 years ago, and one day I had a really exciting meeting that I walked out of, and I think 10 minutes later I had made the decision. So it was nice to have that route, that exit, and I think I jumped a little before I might have jumped, all things being even, but it's worked out well. And and we've got a big we're actually having a native iOS kind of a review app spec search application written up. It's kind of a native app that's going to, I think, be a really big vehicle for finding, I've got a dollar to spend. I want to spend it the best way. And that sounds trivial, but you'd be amazed if you look at the forums at how much people will complain about a dollar that they only, they only think they spend it fairly well. You know, they'd be like, I was saving that dollar. I was saving up for a week for that dollar. You know, this game should have been free. You know, it's crazy the amount of stuff. So that dollar is very important, and I think the app is going to help us with that. And that's kind of right now my biggest role is doing back end, not the programming, but kind of some of the things that need to be done. Supporting that app, and then I'll come back heavier to writing after that launches in about 2 months.
And were you talking about? Cool. Is it the PlayStation Vita?
The Vita, yeah, the Vita.
Yeah, okay.
So basically, yeah, the iPad 2 and the PS, I'm sorry, the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S have basically more than half the, you know, they've got close to the same CPU power,
yeah,
and they've got 50% the GPU power of that device. And but the thing is, you know, you've got it already because it's your phone. You know, it's already in your pocket. You know, it's not like you're having a Vita in your pocket also, and you know, it's these devices. They're definitely taking the spotlight and changing the whole playing field of what, you know, where games are played. And I think that's going to be they're really going to be where it's at.
Sony was talking about adding a phone to the game system, which I don't know if that, I don't think that would, that will work.
Well,
I don't think
they
go that direction.
Android. They came out with an Android phone. You know, like
did they come out with it?
Okay, here's a Sony phone. That's an Android, and it'll play games, but they have nothing to do with, you know, so I think Sony has been kind of going in directions that remind me of Apple in the beige days, where you got the Performa 936 and then the 455E. I mean, I think they're kind of confusing consumers, and they're like, look, the Vita is more powerful than a PS3. But we still sell the PS3. It's like, well, what am I supposed to buy? You know, it's. I think they're kind of confusing the. They've made some strange choices, and of course, I hear they got hacked again yesterday.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yesterday,
I think like the third
scrambling
time?
Though. I mean,
2 days ago.
I'm one of those guys. Yeah, they got hacked again. Yeah, I heard that too.
Yeah, I mean, they have had a hard time. I mean, I don't know, but what, they've made some strange choices.
Go ahead, Carrington. Were you saying something?
Just that I was going to say that I had. You know, every handheld gaming system, like all of them. I had the Lynx. I mean, I've had all the Nintendo things, all of that. Mm-hmm. But I eventually, like, now I'm all iOS all the time because it's on me, and I can pick up games that are fun for $1 or $2, maybe $5 and whatever. And I couldn't tell you how many disappointingly awful games I purchased for, like, a Nintendo handheld that were $39,
$49, $59. $49, right. The price.
And I would play them for half an hour. Yeah.
People complain about these prices in the App Store. You know, like, I paid $2 for this game. This is insane. Yeah. You know, they're like, this is, I want, you know, I'm never going to be able to get back those $2, you know, and I'll add, or the 3 weeks you've spent complaining about it in the forums, you know, you're not going to get that back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because $2, I mean, that's half a mocha.
Yeah, that's, I know, right. I spilt that much mocha out of my cup this morning.
Yeah, it's so crazy. There was a good,
I'll just say quickly, I take every 2 months, I go into GameStop and I take a photograph of the DS and the PSP wall, like the games on the wall. And I have those ready to send out with the prices, $39, $49, so that when I see that, every now and then I can say, that's an old one. No, it's less than 2 months old. And I'll send them the picture, yep. And they're like, you don't know what you're talking about.
And I think that's what's got Nintendo and Sony scrambling is because they can see it. I mean, if you've already dropped maybe a few $100 on a device, an iPod Touch or an iPhone that you have on you, and you can get 100,000 games for less than $5 a piece, I have no motivation at all to pick up a PSV when it comes out, or to pick up the Nintendo 3DS or any of that. Because why would I bother?
Exactly.
And the economics of this, that's definitely...
And I just don't want to carry another device.
It's definitely why it's getting all the mind share. I mean, if you notice, I mean, at least in the popular tech news and, you know, developer time, I guess, you know, how much developer bandwidth is being spent on what, it's a huge shift over to the mobile space. And not just in gaming, but, I mean, primarily in that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I think Electronic Arts came out and they made a statement, was it like a month and a half or 2 months ago, you know, indicating that the future, you know, of gaming is definitely the mobile devices, focusing on the tablet, the iPad. Like, you say the tablet, but you're not talking about the tablet. You're talking about the iPad. You know, there have been tablets around since the late 80s.
There is tablets. And there is no tablet market, really speaking. No. There's an iPad market.
Right, and you know, and I got to say, like, it's the iPad that I do most of my iOS gaming on, because it really does provide a better experience, because you've got all the goodness of the multi-touch screen, but it's also bigger, and it is, you know, it's the fastest. It's even a little faster than the 4S, which was clocked down just a bit to kind of keep things manageable on its battery, and it's and now with iOS 5, you can wirelessly send. Stream the video out onto your Apple TV, and the Apple TV is like what, $80? It's like $80. You know, it's like you almost walk out of the store with one stuck to your pants leg. You know, it's like,
yeah, that's going to be a killer combo going forward. I think I think the combination of that is going to be massive, much bigger than I think people are giving credit for at the moment. I really anticipate that being a really big thing in gaming.
And I agree. I've played with some of these, a number of developers support the wired connection to a big screen, and now more and more supporting the wireless with iOS 5. For months, I've been playing some of these wired games on the big screen, and you know, you plug it in, and when your display goes on the big screen, your device turns into a control display. Like, the display looks like a control pad, and that's amazing. That's an amazing experience. Yeah. And again, these are with $2 games. You know.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. Hey, I hate to do it, but I'm going to move us along.
Yeah.
there's actually a ton. There's tons to talk about in today's show. And, I mean, it's interesting that we're on the subject of iOS because, of course, I'm sure most, if not all, of the listeners of Retro Computing Roundtable are aware, as well as, you know, most people just in the world in general. Since the last recording of Retro Computing Roundtable, unfortunately, Steve Jobs has passed away. He was ill for quite some time, was battling, you know, a rather rare, as I understand it, form of cancer, and, you know, had ups and downs, of course, had to leave Apple for a while on a medical leave and then came back and then left again permanently, not too long, actually, before he passed away. So I'd like to acknowledge that, you know, rest in peace, Steve Jobs, and definitely chat about his life, the legacy that he left behind, you know, and also some of the both the truths and the myths, I would say, of Steve Jobs' biography. So David had put together a good deal of notes on this kind of an outline for us to chat about today. So I think for this piece, I'll hand it over to you, David. You could kick us off.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Earl. Yeah, and in regarding his death, it wasn't I don't think it was a surprise to anyone, but it was just shocking nonetheless. And I know that I have read and heard this numerous times, what I'm about to say, I guess, is that me and my wife were out to dinner on that evening, and so she found out about his death on her iPhone. And then I've heard that, you know, from lots of other people about they're using an iOS device, and when they found out about his death. So
I was as well. I was out playing pool with my double take co-host, Sherry, and a girl that was out with us was the one who told us, and she had found out by reading like a Twitter feed or something on her iPhone.
Yeah, I constantly heard Twitter and, of course, Facebook, and in this case, a coworker, my wife's, you know, text her, you know, so obviously felt that was important to, you know, you want to tell people. And then we ended up telling someone in the restaurant, you know, you just feel like it's information you should pass on. Yeah, so in the notes we laid out, and of course, we'll much as possible, put this in the show notes. But I know I added, pre-show, you had mentioned that Governor Brown had declared today the official Steve Jobs Day. So
yes.
Just to mention that first. And actually, I'm going there real quick. Yeah, did he mention it just for today? Because it seems kind of like, is that something you would mention for like a future day so you get the full day out of it? But I guess it's literally today, our recording.
I think it was actually declared today.
Yeah, so today, Sunday, October 16th, will be Steve Jobs Day. So anyway, there's an article there. And then, Blake, I actually put while you're talking, I was linking off, looking at some of your links and stuff, and I found your Flickr account where you had taken pictures of your Apple store and with Post-it notes and stuff. And I've seen other pictures of other stores, but your Flickr stream is really good. It has a lot of pictures of – which store is it? I don't –
Yeah, no, it was the Clarence. It's the I guess strangely, I've got four stores within 15 minutes of my house in the greater DC area. But the one I consider my own, so to speak, is the Clarendon. Yeah, it's Arlington, Virginia, and the night it happened, and I'll say I found out on a Mac. You know, I was on my laptop at home, and I just felt like I should go to the store, you know. So like at midnight I went over there and there were flowers there and there were a few people, and then the following days I went over there, I guess two nights later, when I heard there was a big display of Post-it notes, and I took photos late at night, and then it was so great I really wanted to get some daytime shots, and I was hoping they'd still be up. So I went the next day, I guess it was, you know, three or four days after he had passed away.
There are a lot more.
And I got, well, there were definitely more, but I got some really, I tried to get some really clear shots. And I think that if you really zoom in on the shots, they're such that you can almost read all of the notes. And that's kind of what I was going for, you know, just to kind of record it. And now they're gone, you know, of course, when the 4S launch happened, I was in line, they weren't there anymore. But
it tells you a lot about... you know, and obviously I would guess that probably the large majority, if not every one of those people, did not know him personally.
No, I'm sure.
But it's
not.
Just something about how he touched our lives and we feel connected with him in these notes we have in our show notes. That's why I've heard parallels of him. Actually, you know what, I'm going to jump do the notes here and go to the N one first. So I've heard parallels of him to Thomas Edison. I think I read one that was very good about sort of comparing him to Frank Lloyd Wright, so the architect. And they're good parallels, but personally I tend to parallel him the most to Walt Disney, the man. And so there's a lot of similarities there. And so just to kick off there, and you guys jump in, but on the first line I put that, you know, they're both talented people. So Walt Disney was an artist, and he got started through his own artistic abilities. He wasn't necessarily a great artist. And ultimately, he stopped being an artist, but he was the creative visionary of the company. And he pushed, you know, finding other creative people and leading the vision and the creative flow of the company. And Steve Jobs actually started tinkering around. He was technically minded. It wasn't like he was a total, didn't know anything about electronics. He was no Steve Wozniak, but he had some technical ability, but he pretty much got away from that and then, you know, became sort of the same thing, you know, like a visionary. And so that was one of my notes there. Yeah, more about attracting talent. They, they both went on to form companies, and they were both very visionary, futurists, and they're, you know, in Walt Disney's case, I'm a huge Disney fan too. So he was very nostalgic, like at a Walt Disney World, at Disneyland. Main Street is sort of a version of like the perfected town he grew up in or whatever. But he was very much a futurist. They both reinvented their companies different times. You know, the Disney studio started off as an animation studio. They completely innovated all kinds of the first full-featured color cartoon, you know, movie. Can't think of the type of camera it was, but it was able to do. Anybody else here a big Disney person?
Go ahead.
Well, so he invented a type of camera that was able to make like sort of a 3D feeling in animated cartoons. I can't think of what it was called. But anyway, so Disney started off doing this, but then of course he moved into doing live action movies, and then of course obviously into theme parks. And I think there's at least parallels there to how Apple obviously started with computers. I mean, they're still in computers, but then they, you know, moved into music and to obviously software as being a strength over just hardware. You know, ultimately into the, you know, phone communications, you know, even dropping computers out of the name. And lastly, I put a line item as a comparison of Walt Disney or Walt. Something really came to mind to me. I want to talk about a few months ago. I watched the video about Steve Jobs in front of the Cupertino City Council. And he was talking about the future Apple campus. And the moment I started watching that on YouTube, and I guess I'll put a link to that, is I immediately thought of Walt Disney standing in front of the map of Epcot. The last TV show of Disneyland or whatever he was featured, he died actually before that aired. And of course, Epcot did not come to be what his original intentions were. It became a theme park. And I just made me think, you know, Steve Jobs with the Apple campus just made me think of that. And then I got to wonder, what is the future Apple campus? Is it really going to come about to be just like what he showed the city council there, what he envisioned is going to change? But I want to do all the talking here. What do you guys think? Look over to the list here, and you know, there's obviously some misconceptions about Steve Jobs. And you know, what were his true accomplishments? How about I'll ask questions. what would anyone say is the true accomplishments of Steve Jobs?
I would say that he birthed, if you will, products out of Apple by like sheer force of will. I know that that's kind of you got to separate the myth from the man, but I think by most accounts, when he wanted to do something, you know, even if it wasn't necessarily the most popular thing or whatever, he'd just push for it and refine it and tweak it. And they would say, you know, if you're talking with Steve Jobs, you'd be, what did they call it? The reality distortion field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
So basically bending reality to his own will to get something accomplished for the company. And it's unclear to me, I mean, nobody can absolutely duplicate that formula. It's unclear to me how you actually accomplish it. It seems like it's a combination of charisma and intelligence and willpower and stuff like that. But yeah, I agree with you, David, more so than possibly technical talent, obviously, was just this combination of talents that allowed things to come out, like the iPhone and the iPad and the iMac and all the other lowercase I devices.
And like Walt Disney, perhaps, in this comparison, what do my customers want? And in general, what do people want? Because, anyway, go ahead.
It's interesting. I've heard several people say, well, you know, right, if you ask, maybe it was Jobs that said it, in fact, if you ask people what they wanted in Henry Ford's time, they'd say they wanted a faster horse.
Right,
you know,
right.
They wouldn't say they want a car. I think one of the things that amazes me, and it makes it seem almost more like an epic story, epic in meeting the requirements of being like this supernatural, stars are aligned kind of situation, is, you know, he came in, obviously Woz was the technical guy. He was building a computer, but he was building it for himself. That was his main interest. And so, Jobs saw what it could be, and he started pushing it with his vision. And he went right through, you know, I think he was there when the 2C pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so he got fired, basically. You know, he got pushed out by Scully. And so he went off... you know, we've all heard stories about his managerial style, a little harsh, to say the least, at times. And so he went out and created Next. And so basically, and I've been an enormous Next fan since day one. You know, I've got a Next station, and you know, I'm just a Next guy. And anyway, so he created Next, and what he created was an exceptional, overpriced, but an exceptional workstation. That from a software and technological perspective was just, you know, it was just praised, you know, universally. But as a product on the market, it was just too expensive. And so it saw very, very little success. He moved it to software only. And then he was basically at the end of his rope. He comes back to Apple through the fortuitous, twist of events and I can't remember the CEO. What's the name of the CEO that was there?
Oh, Gil Amelio.
Yeah, Amelio. So anyway, so he comes back, and I think what happened was he did so well. He created such a good thing, but it would fail. And I think he learned humility to some degree at Next. And so when he came back, I think it was necessary for him to have gone through the experience of creating an exceptional, really a second to none product, but having it, you know, not recognized in the way he wanted, which was, you know, commercially and publicly, that, you know, he was then ready to take everything to the next level. And of course, immediately he turned Apple around. I saw a video of him talking about he had a meeting early on, and he was in shorts and sandals in front of the Apple people. He had a turtleneck, but it was shorts and a sandals. And, you know, he said, hey, you know, okay, you know, we've got to, anyone interested in turning or in making Apple great again, let's get started now. Anyone else, get out, walk out. And and he did exactly that. And I think, I don't know if he could have done it if he hadn't gone through that growth experience of, you know, the ups and downs of Next.
Yeah, I think he had to fail. He ultimately had to kind of fail to then come back. Go ahead, yeah. Kerrigan.
I was going to say, what's interesting is, And I agree with everything you've said, and I do believe he had to go through that process to become the Apple leader that he eventually was. But what he didn't get from the Next experience of creating something amazing that doesn't sell is he didn't lose his balls, though. He came out and said, okay, let's bring Apple out, and I'm going to put out an iMac, and it's going to have no floppy because that's the way it should be.
Risk-taking, very important.
He still would be willing to say, this is the future, this is right. It would be so easy to come out of that Next thing and then put out something and say, you know what, we got to make more compromises, we got to sell. And a lot of people forget that the first 3 or 4 years that he came back to Apple, their sales went down year after. But what they started doing was, you know, cleaning house and getting rid of all the 15 different versions of the Performer,
that focusing.
Kind of stuff. And they increased, then they started becoming actually more profitable, though their sales kept dropping. And he turned it into a successful company that way. And he was just really a visionary that way, but still had the guts to take a risk on something that he believed was right. And that is what has made Apple great after all the years that he came back, was still having the the guts, the fortitude to stick to his guns and say, this is, people don't know what they want this, but this is the future I believe in, and let's present it make it awesome.
Yeah. And that was when I just added on the list here. That's one of the big parallels between him and Walt Disney too, risk taking. You know, Walt Disney and his company almost went bankrupt a number of times. They were hugely successful after Snow White, the first animated, full-length animated feature film or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they almost lost all the money. And then by the time Disneyland, the park was starting to be built. I mean, this happened a few times. So risk-taking was another important thing. Right, where Steve Jobs wasn't just out to be successful, per se, rich, but to just make a great product. One thing I want to and Blake, I'm not specifically correcting you, but as a misconception, because I know in Steve Jobs' 2007 commencement speech, which is awesome, and everybody should watch that, he also said he was fired, which I think is not absolutely true. He was fired from his position. Technically, when you say you're fired from a company, right?
Right.
So he was fired
but not
from
out of the company.
Yeah, he was not fired from the company. He resigned from the company.
Right.
So minor.
And then he sold all his stock except one share. I don't know if you guys had known that, but. Because he disagreed so much with the direction the company was going, he sold all of his Apple stock except for a single share.
So for most people, I would say I would bet that they regretted that. But, he just doesn't strike me as the kind of person who labored over regrets very often.
No.
I think also the timing was interesting. I mean, for all of us who had been Apple fans throughout the years, myself since the 70s with the Apple II, it was really painful to live through those years in the early 90s and wonder what's going to happen with Apple.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They did great stuff, but man, they're on the ropes. You know, they're down and the referee is, counting 7, 8, you're just about
nine.
Gone.
Yeah, he said nine. I think nine was spoken.
Mm-hmm. And then, again, through that sequence of events where Next became a part of Apple and Steve Jobs reassimilated into the company, I mean, those of us on the sidelines looking at this, we're just going, I bet this is going to be a harbinger of good things. And so I think there was an entire segment of the tech community that really didn't want to see Apple perish. I mean, at the time, there were rumors they were going to get purchased by Sun, by IBM. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A variety of companies had considered actually taking Apple and gobbling it up, but it didn't happen. And then those events happened. So I think, part of the success, the ambiance or whatever you want to call it, could have been just the tech world celebrating that, hey, maybe Apple's not going to go under. And of course, that excitement had to be followed on with real change and real product, which of course it was. But I just think the timing was good too.
And we won't stay on the topic too much longer. But see, another one I really wanted to point to, because I've heard this in my company when some people are talking about Steve Jobs and Apple. I've heard it so many times, and about that Apple basically stole intellectual property from Xerox. They ripped off Xerox with the mouse and Windows and the GUI and all this other stuff, and that is just not true.
Besides, Xerox is a copy company. You think they'd be okay with that?
Well, I mean, basically Apple, before they went public, they were a hot commodity or hot corporation or whatever. And so Xerox basically, Apple traded Xerox to have first shot at buying a huge amount
of stock.
First issue stock before they went public. Right. And so in exchange, they gave Apple a look-see over at the Xerox Alto. And a lot of times people talk about the Xerox Star, which they were working on. It didn't come out to 81. So this is like 79. And yes, Xerox had a mouse in place with the Xerox Alto, which they licensed from Douglas Engelbart's SRI lab. They did have a graphical user interface. They did not have, like Apple pioneered the one button mouse, ease of use, intuitive interface, the pull down menus, things that did not exist on the Alto.
Right.
So they didn't invent all of it, no, but they certainly perfected it, and they didn't steal code. They had to, from the ground up, make this stuff.
Yeah, no, if I could jump in, definitely. I remember the details, and I've read a few of the Apple history. Well, I think one of my favorites is
Are you looking for it?
Yeah, the Little Kingdom by Morris.
Yeah, I think they it's been updated.
It.
Yeah,
yeah, they republished it with like a new foreword. Yeah, I hunted down the old version and read it like 4 years ago. It's an excellent read. It's you know, kind of like a Soul of the New Machine, but for Apple. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they had the stock exchange for their day over there. But I was going to also say that folks should hunt down Engelbart. There's an exceptional video. I think it's from the late 60s of Douglas Engelbart.
Yeah, we talked about it. Was it last show, guys, or one
was
show?
It? Two shows
yeah.
ago.
Yeah, we linked to it.
Demos.
Yeah, that's great. Right. The Motherball, the mouse wasn't even the star of that. I mean, the mouse was a peripheral, but like the it was more of the concept, as I guess you covered in the last one, which somehow I don't remember, even though I listened to it. But yeah, so that was an amazing thing to watch. And so yeah, I'm just reiterating, I guess.
And, you know, I think probably it makes sense that Apple didn't steal technology from Xerox, because if you think about the relative sizes of the companies back in those days, I mean, now Apple is, of course, the giant Goliath, but it certainly wasn't then. And I doubt that Xerox would have been a good company to go stealing intellectual property from at that point. So yeah, I think those myths are not only not founded, but also not really credible, given that Apple would have had their clock cleaned.
And for that matter, you could argue more strongly that Microsoft stole from Apple, but in their defense, I wouldn't even say that's correct, actually, because the paradigm of the graphical user interface or the desktop interface, there's only so many ways you could kind of do it.
Yeah. And I think it's already out there.
Yeah, or the perfect example is like the dashboard of an automobile, where the steering wheel is and the pedals and the gears and everything else. How many different ways are you going to try to do that? If you're going to now create a dashboard for your automobile, how are you going to you're not going to change it too dramatically. So on this topic with Steve Jobs, Earl, I'll hand it back over to you, but I want to ask one last question then, and then I'll if you guys want to say anything more about it. So what does each of us think then would be if you had to pick one, what do you feel like is the most crowning device that Steve Jobs will be known for? I mean, the Macintosh would be an obvious possible choice. Maybe the iPhone. What do you think?
iPhone.
And I'll jump in. So I think I had to think about it, but I think iPhone ultimately too.
I think it's the Pippin.
Yeah.
He wasn't with the company then. That's just
No, I think iPhone. I think iOS as well. I think that is going to have a resonance far greater than the Macintosh did of its time, because it's going to be think it will be I don't remember which Star Trek movie it was, one of them where they go back to 1985 or 1986.
Star Trek 4.
Okay, yeah. And Scotty, I think, picks up the mouse. The speaking
mouse.
It doesn't have to use the mouse. And it only occurred
to
me
because they didn't have Siri.
Exactly, but at the time, right. I thought that was funny. But, of course, in the Star Trek universe, there's just touchscreens, just like we're going towards now. And it's funny how we sort of, even back when mouse-activated computers were a new thing and new and exciting, and that's the future, even then, we all knew, well, eventually, we're going to have all just working our fingers on things, and it's just taken us a while to get there.
The original Star Trek, there was only voice commands. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe that's not completely true, because I'm sure they had keyboards, but in the series, pretty much everything's done by them talking to the computer.
They had those colored buttons. They were like pretty buttons stuck up.
Yeah.
But I will say, I can invalidate everything the characters said about the future and the vision in Star Trek, because Picard was bald. I mean, you know, the guy was how many years in the future and he's still bald? I mean, he would have hair.
Blake, right? I know, Kemp Picard was the next generation.
Wouldn't he have like an afro or something? I don't know.
He did. He had a big clear afro.
A clear afro. It was like a magnetic line.
Yeah, it was
transparent
aluminum.
In the high-definition versions, you can actually see the pick floating.
Transparent aluminum, that's good.
It was a transporter error.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
So, I guess I'll go with iPhone and iOS as well. I'll join the crowd, because I think, ultimately, the smart devices of whatever sort 10 years from now, they'll probably look a lot different. But this is where you could see it really start to get traction. And people will say, well, there were smartphones before that. And, you know, there were tablets before the iPad and that sort of thing. It's true. But again, it's got to be this combination of fit and finish and industrial engineering and, user friendliness and that variety of things. I think the stars, what'd you say, Blake? How'd you put it? The stars were just aligned.
Yeah, I mean, a cosmic, you know, right, the stars aligned, and that's
well,
what happened.
I mean, the iPhone is a Macintosh to a certain extent, but I've had some arguments about this with some people that I argue the iPhone was the first smartphone based on that. If you have to define a smartphone now, or even in 2007, I argue that a true smartphone is internet capable, obvious perhaps, so was the BlackBerry, but the iPhone had a real web browser.
Right.
Real desktop quality web browser, therefore making it the first smartphone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, agreed.
It's interesting because I don't know if it was the first. Do you guys know where it had a, like, its width was virtual? Like, it had a virtual wider web page, but it gave you a scalable,
like,
view,
a real browser,
you know?
Yeah.
Right, and that made it wasn't like, oh, look, now we're viewing it in 300 pixels, you know, which mm-hmm. was a lost cause, but this would scale it. And I'll say while I'm speaking, you know, the whole next step thing next step I was talking about, you know, I got the $5,000 loan in college. I ran Next Step and I saw Next Step fail. I'm running Next Step in my pocket right now. Basically.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so that's like, you know, the joke's on you. I mean, you know, Jobs definitely he won. You know, he got it, and we all get to experience how good that is.
And you're still paying that student loan.
Yeah. Now I said, you know, one day I'm going to pay off that 46. I'm still dancing down in D.C. at the club. I'm going to get it. It's going to be finished soon. Yeah.
So. I guess in the interest of time, we should wrap up on that. But thanks for putting together that outline, David.
Okay.
That piece of the conversation. And again, rest in peace, Steve. As I said on my tweet, you know, thanks for all the good stuff you gave us.
Oh, and the last thing, if I can just say one last thing, then I'll put some links, you know, more links in here, but especially to his Stanford University address and also the interview from 2005, the Stanford one, and 2007 is the All Things Digital, where him and Bill Gates are interviewed. Both of these are just really awesome and worth watching.
All must see. If you haven't seen those, that's true.
And there's plenty of other stuff you can watch, but Steve Jobs, I mean, but those two really stand out.
Cool.
So it has been a sad, you know, time here in the world of computing legacy, because this last week, we also lost another pioneer in the computing field, Dennis Ritchie. Dennis Ritchie was the creator of the C programming language and also a co-creator and one of the early innovators on the Unix operating system. And I would say that while he is obviously not nearly as well known, prominent a figure as Steve Jobs, the technologies that he developed and the technology legacy that he left behind is probably equally impactful. I mean, when I think about it, practically every piece of technology that I use every day incorporates these pieces that Dennis Ritchie was influential in creating. And in fact, even if you want to look at it from a second generation or third generation removed, you know, possibly the keyboard that I'm using here, my wireless keyboard, wasn't programmed in C, but I'm betting that the design program that they used to create this keyboard was probably programmed in C. You know, somewhere in the parentage, C and Unix were involved in everything from my microwave oven to the electronics in my car. It's just amazing how many things we can trace back to this work. So,
yeah, I think, he didn't enter the public consciousness as much as Steve Jobs. I think an argument could be made that his actions have had as much of an influence on technology in our lives as Steve Jobs did. It just was sort of more under the radar, but massive resonance in technology, this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he won a Turing Award, which I don't think Steve Jobs ever did, so there.
He was awarded, actually, with quite a few prestigious honors in the computing world. As you mentioned, he did win the Turing Award. He also won the Richard W. Hamming Medal from the IEEE Society.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
The National Medal of Technology, mm-hmm. Which he received from Bill Clinton. I'm reading some of this from Wikipedia, but Also, the Japan Prize, which he won recently, he, along with Ken Thompson, they were awarded the Japan Prize for Information and Communications for his work on the Unix operating system. So, you know, lots of, again, awards behind the scenes, not necessarily something that would be picked up on by the general public.
And I think all of us who code, if you're above the age of 12 or something like that, have all owned and read the KNR. I mean,
yes,
everybody has.
Yes, right. The white book with the big blue C on the front. That's is a famous work. I would say, you know, probably a patriarchal work in computing. And we were talking before the show, you know, we've pretty much still, we've got those books on our bookshelf today. And, I've still got a number of C compilers that I poke around with for the various retro platforms. But you could haul out that, especially the second edition, the ANSI edition of C, and that would still have utility all these years later. So,
sure. The second, I have both, but the second edition of that book was one of my programming Bibles for so many years.
Same with me, definitely.
And very well written, I thought, from the aspect that sometimes people who are very technical.
This is the end of part one. Part two in the works.